The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey, listener, are you happy with your current chicken wings? Do you wish you had something a little saucier? If you answered yes, then it might be time for you to break up with your old chicken wings and get a new honey. Lemon pepper wing from Popeyes. Share the wings with your friends so they can see it's time to move on, too. Head to Popeyes and get 6-piece honey lemon pepper wings for $5.99. At participating U.S. restaurants, price may vary.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pot of thunder and rock and roll. And thank God it's Friday, because that means it's time for the Duff McKagan Joke of the Week.
Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan calling you, man. Listen, breaking news. The toilets were stolen at the police station. Yeah, police have nothing to go on. Thank you very much. Bye.
All right, that was good. Duff's been on a roll lately. He's a little bit on fire. I know you laughed at that one. Thanks to Duff. He never lets us down. And thanks to everyone who's been watching the Winnipeggers on my Facebook page and YouTube channel. New episodes every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern. And last night, it was songs you almost know the words to. Dave Ribo and I shared all the song lyrics that we used to get wrong as kids. Some funny ones like the Elton John classic, Get Back Copycat. That's what I thought it was called. Ribo used to sing Bring Me a Hired Love for Steve Winwood. And Dave's got a few good ones too. I don't know what the hell he's talking about. Come sing along to the wrong lyrics. Have a couple laughs. We even got a girl in a bikini this week. Join us on the Winnipeggers on my Facebook page and YouTube channel. And speaking of music, I got two great guests today who are sharing some really cool stories about the rise and fall of the 80s LA metal scene. Tom Bojour, co-founder of Revolver Magazine, and Rich Beanstalk, former editor of Guitar World. They interviewed a couple hundred musicians, managers, producers, roadies, and label execs for their new book, Nothing But a Good Time, The Uncensored History of the 80s Hard Rock Explosion. They talked to everyone from Ozzy to Poison to Skid Row to Warrant to Guns N' Roses, Motley Crue, lesser-known bands like Tough and Lizzie Borden, to detail the rise and fall of the 80s metal scene on the Sunset Strip, share some of the amazing stories they uncovered, including Slash's failed audition for Poison, think about that, Sebastian Bach's shocking first night with Skid Row and the debauchery that ensued, the weird practical joke that Dokken played on producer Tom Werman, and the Warrant and Guns N' Roses flyer feud. That's right. Duff was going to kick their asses, by the way. He's not all about jokes, guys. They talk about the explosion of the 80s scene and the Sunset Strip culture and whether the rise of grunge and bands like Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, Nirvana really played a big role in the demise of the metal scene and music. This is truly sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's the stuff of legend, and you're about to hear all about it now with Tom Bojour and Rich Beanstalk. It's going to be nothing but a good time on Talk is Jericho. I got to be honest, one of the best books I've read in a long time is Nothing But a Good Time by Tom Bojour and Richard Beanstalk.
Thank you.
And it's funny because there's a lot of books written about rock and roll, about certain time frames, and a lot of books written kind of about the 80s, which was a glorious time for rock and roll. So when we have a mutual friend, Richard, I think Pete Fornatale, who
yes,
has been my collaborator for years, kind of said you should check out this book. And a couple of my friends had sent me pictures and stuff. So I don't really know what to expect. And then when you open this book and just see, like, oh my gosh, right off the bat, you have this list of people that you've interviewed for the book, and it's just off the chain, ridiculously expansive of 250 people plus or whatever it is. First of all, congratulations on a great book that entails the entire history of kind of the LA scene. Second of all, how did you come up with the idea to do this project, and how did you get it started to get all these people involved?
Well, Tom and I both are Guitar World magazine alumnus. We that's where we met about 25 years ago, actually. And so we've worked together there for many years, over a decade, and then we've just worked together on and off on other things since then. But back in the Guitar World days when we were in the office, I mean, Tom and I, this is the music we grew up on, the music that we love, the music that we're obsessed with. So we basically would always just have these insane hair metal conversations. And, you know, at some point, like many years ago, the discussion came up about whether to do a book like this. And I think we were both a little bit scared to take it on because of our fandom. We knew like that's a rabbit hole we were going to crawl into and then die and never find out. So we just put it off. And then about 4 years ago was when we had the conversation, let's do this. And so that was really when we started it. So it was a good, I mean, we handed in the book about a year ago. So it was a solid 3 years of work.
And in the beginning, basically what you have to sort of do is leverage whatever relationships you have to get the interviews, you know, to get people to actually talk to you when you don't have a book deal yet.
Right.
So you have, that was the sort of the first 6 months is a little bit the trickiest part where you're like basically banking on the fact that doing Guitar World, and I started Revolver magazine. Mm. So I did that for 10 years. So all of those relationships, people know you enough that when you put in the call, like, hey, we're working on this book, that like there's enough of a trust element there that they'll get on the phone with you. And it's kind of a lot to ask of people, you know, like they're not promoting something. They don't know how it's going to end up, if it's ever going to come out and stuff. But people were really generous with their time. Stephen Piercy from Rat was really generous. A couple of the producers like Tom Worman, who did like all the Motley Crue stuff and, you know, did a really great interview. Some guys from Dokken. So that was the real beginning, was like getting a foothold before we had the deal and being able to get enough people. You know, we probably talked to about 50 people to be able to write the chapters that enabled us to then do the book. So that was the really, like, where you're throwing Hail Marys a lot of the time. Like,
well, it's also typical Hollywood where, you know, who else is involved.
Yes.
And to get enough names to be involved, to get to the tipping point to where now everybody wants to be involved. So who was kind of the first big name that you had where you could go, hey, so-and-so did it. So now it's like, wow, David Lee Roth wants to do it now because so-and-so did it. Or maybe it was David Lee Roth that was first. So who were some of those big names that you got that were able to influence the rest of the book?
I think, you know, I will say, I mean, Tom mentioned Stephen Piercy, and Stephen Piercy came on the first day, actually. He was, oddly enough, he was the second interview that we did. The first one, I believe, was Marshall Burl, who was Rat's manager back in the, and that was just random, like reaching out to him, and he responded. And then later that day, Stephen was there. So that helped. And I think Tom spoke to JJ French early on, you know, having Twisted Sister on board doesn't hurt. The Dokken guys were already there. So we started to sort of amass it. I mean, I'm certainly not saying this is sort of toot our own horns, but I think that early on, like, we were just leaning more on our backgrounds.
Yeah.
More than the guys that were involved in like the Guitar World thing, but also we both write for Rolling Stone and Billboard and all these other places. So I think people saw that as legitimate, and that helped a lot.
And also some business people came on early, and we really wanted to get them their perspectives anyway, but like getting Jason Flom, who like signed, you know, all those bands to Atlantic.
Everybody.
And is still like, he signed Greta Van Fleet recently. And he's like, so like, once you get like him, and we got Cliff Bernstein really early, like for who manages Metallica and managed everybody. And once you get like those guys too, it sends a signal to the artists that you're going deep, that you know what you're doing, that like respected people are talking to you, and that you're not going to, mainly I think for a lot of the artists, that you're not just going to ask them the same five
questions. Of course. And that's always the secret to having a good interview. It's one of the reasons why my podcast has lasted as long as it has, is I don't want the same answers. You know, you want to kind of delve deeper. And that's what you guys did, which was so cool, because once again, you had so many names that we can get it, because I'm a aficionado of this scene too. But to me, I think it's one of those things that, like, I remember I was talking to somebody about Beatlemania once. And he was like, listen, if you weren't there, you don't really get just how big it was. And I think it's the same for, you know, this scene. You could call it hair metal. You could call it glam. You could call it the LA scene. But just that time frame from like 81 to 91, just how huge and massive the heavy metal scene was. Did you guys like, and obviously you knew that because you lived it too, but kind of going back to that time frame, were you amazed and kind of forgot? Like, holy shit, like Motley Crue was huge. Like, you forget just how huge Motley Crue was. I mean, they're big now, but then it was like almost a religion of how people just flocked to this band more than almost any other one.
I think the thing with MTV particularly is like what you get reminded during this book is that the people in these bands weren't just successful, they were famous. And that is not something that really happens that much with rock musicians at all anymore. This is like what you're saying. It was this era where, you know, Dee Snider talks about it early on of like Twisted Sister's been knocking around for 10 years before they finally get their break. And I think he probably in a weird way would have just wanted to have a platinum record and be like, okay, I made it. Right. But suddenly he's famous, like TV famous, the guys in Poison, the guys in Motley Crue. And, you know, even later on in the era, like Gunnar Nelson was talking to me and he's like, you know, it got to the point where like I could go to the mall or my brother could go to the mall. If we went together, like he's like, I'm not kidding. There was a riot. Like it was actual Beatlemania, like where they had to actually on their tour. This is a bit of an aside, but it's a really funny thing in the book. They go out on tour and they literally have to keep adding PA, like wattage, because the screams
are so loud.
Loud. But I don't think people are able to look back at a time where like this was the thing, like it was the thing that was happening. And you turn on MTV and this was it. Nothing can be this massive again.
You know, and I think you're right, because it was, you know, gosh, it's so crazy because even though it was only 30 years ago, it was still 30 years ago. And how much times have changed since then? Because I remember, too, like I was really into Nelson when they first came out. I actually told Matthew and Gunnar this. I kind of modeled my look after them. And I was also a diehard Metallica fan, Anthrax fan, all that stuff, Maiden. But something about Nelson just grabbed me. And it was kind of, like you said, like girls just going crazy and going to shopping malls. And I'm sure you kind of still get that now. But are there even shopping malls to go to for these, you know, for this to happen? So like we said, even though it was in our lifetimes, it's from a time frame that people like our kids will never understand what that was like. And it was so close, but it was a galaxy ago.
Yeah. And I mean, Tom and I have talked about the fact that there was that period from like 1988 to 1991, where like every Saturday night at midnight, like you were there watching Headbangers Ball to see like what the new video was. And like everybody knew what that new video was on Monday morning. Like, you know, and that speaks to sort of this whole idea of the monoculture not existing anymore. But it, you know, this is another aspect of how it is different now when you look at this music, because people who were into this music back then were just insane about this music, you know, the same way I was and Tom was and you were, and like you knew everything about it and you just needed to know everything about it. You picked up every issue of Circus and Hip Parader and Rip and Faces and Metal Edge and whatever it was, and like you watched Hard 30 and Hard 60 and Headbangers Ball. You know, those awful like VHS cassettes of like, I forget what those were called, that you'd rent them.
Heavy Metal Mania or something.
Yeah, like that, all that stuff. And so Hard and Heavy, like that kind of stuff.
That was it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but it's just like, and I don't think, like, I know that's the way I was, but I know that I wasn't the only kid like that. Like, that's the way the fans were about this stuff. And so I think that's what makes this period really special too. And that's what we really wanted to sort of get across in the book, like the excitement, and also writing this in a way that we know the people who really want to read this book are people like us that know are coming into it knowing a lot and having a lot of really deep and intense feelings sometimes about this stuff. Mm-hmm. So we want to give them something that maybe they hadn't heard before.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
kind of going through like the high points of like from band points of view, it all kind of kicks off with Quiet Riot, like you said, kind of moves over to Twisted Sister a little bit, then Motley Crue comes, then it goes to kind of a Guns N' Roses thing, then like you mentioned, the last kind of last wave of Nelson and Firehouse and Trickster and those sort of things. When you think of those points, was this music destined to only have these 10 years? You know what I mean? Like how it started and how it ended, it came in like a bang and kind of went out with a little bit of a whimper. Is that just kind of how styles of music go? Did hair metal, for lack of a better term, last longer than it should have? Was it the right amount of time? Because you talk to a lot of bands that if they would have come out a few years earlier, might have been 10 times bigger.
I think Steve Brown from Trickster, who's actually like a kind of a buddy, is...
Yeah, a good friend of mine, too.
He's got a really healthy perspective on it. I'm sure you've spoken to him about it, too, where he'll be like, dude, I caught the wave. I had the best time of my life. Yeah. I just wish it had lasted a little longer.
Right.
And to answer your question, though, I think it had run its course. I mean, it had a longer run than a lot of other genres, I feel like of real success. You're talking, you know, like from Quiet Riot through, like, let's say, what's the last giant record, Dr. Feelgood. It's a good run, you know?
Right.
But what's different about it to me is, and so it was, I think, at a point where bands were copying bands, you know? We just had to do a playlist for something, and I did this playlist, and the first song is Motley Crue, Toast of the Town, which was their first single. And then the last song is Pretty Boy Floyd covering Toast of the Town. And like, that's where you see, you know, that the bands were influenced. Like, you already had bands that weren't influenced by Zeppelin. They were influenced by Motley Crue. So it had kind of run its course.
And Motley Crue was still popular at the time. Yeah, so they're exactly all sounding the same, yeah. Right? Yeah.
But what's different is like how this music was. And I mean, it's a new word, and it didn't even exist when we were working on the book, really. This music was canceled. That is what's different, is that by the time you get to like 1992 or 1993,
right,
94, it's like it never happened. I mean, you probably lived through the same thing where it's just like you didn't talk about these bands. They weren't really working. Anyone who worked with them wasn't really working. The producers.
That's
like,
amazing. Yeah.
Everybody just got blown out. So I think that's what's unique is it had a normal arc, but then it just got like, people like had to pretend they weren't even in these bands.
That is a great point, especially when I remember in the book talking about Howard Benson, how he couldn't even find a gig working with anybody because no one wanted to work with the guy that had done Warrant or Winger or whatever it was. Because when you remember, like, that's one of the things that I initially, for me, I fought against grunge. Meanwhile, I was the perfect age for it. I was 21 when Nevermind came out. I mean, I should have been hooked by that. But instead, I rebelled against it because it was killing not just all the bands you mentioned, but if you look at that time frame, Maiden went down. Metallica was just at the very end of their run before they hit the wilderness. And just all of those bands like were just gone. Or if they existed still, they like Warrant was doing Ultra Phobic, which was a little bit more grungy. And there was no place for any of these guys to go.
Yeah, I think, and that's something that we wanted to explore in the book, that obviously the whole grunge thing and Nirvana and all that, but also to kind of explore about what else was going on at the time, because that was certainly a factor. But, you know, we talked to Jerry Cantrell from Alice in Chains, and we talked to Kim Thayil from Soundgarden, and like these guys in those early days, especially, there's a lot of overlap.
Sure. They started as metal guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're playing shows together. You know, Alice in Chains is playing with Extreme, and they're playing with Great White. And Jerry Cantrell was in a band with Vinny Chaz from Pretty Boy Floyd. Like, these guys all know each other. And they didn't think of it as us against them, especially at the beginning. It was just like they were all just hard rock bands trying to make it. And me as a fan, that's kind of the way I felt. Like, I loved Nirvana when they came out and Soundgarden and all that, but I was still listening to my Motley Crue records. And like, it was all just a different form of like the same thing in some ways. But then this thing happens where there really is this split. And part of that is, you know, what we've always talked about with all the grunge stuff. But part of it, and some of the bands in the book make this point, I think Fred Curry from Cinderella is one of the guys. He's like, well, you know, in 90, 91, like a lot of us weren't doing our best work. You know, Cinderella isn't putting out their best album, you know, or Warren or a lot of these guys. I mean, and they're sort of changing already. I mean, the Poison of 1990 is not the same as the Poison of 1986. They look different. They sound different, you know, and that's before Nirvana even comes in as a mainstream force. So like these changes are happening already. And I think because of all these other things we're talking about, like it's been around for a while, the fans are growing up. There's this sort of loop going on with the new bands just being influenced by the bands that are still at the top of their game. So there's a lot of factors going on. And we tried to kind of explore all of those things in addition to the Nirvana thing.
And just to quickly, to your point earlier, because it was so big, it fell really hard. These guys, there was nowhere for them to hide. Like if you're Kip Winger and Metallica's, like your face has been everywhere, or if you're Gunnar or Matthew Nelson, like you can't, like your face is, you can't like, just like, you're like, oh, you know, you can't reinvent yourself if you've been that, or it's going to be really hard if you've been plastered on TV for years.
But it was hard too. Like even the biggest of the big, like Motley Crue with the John Corabi album or Poison with the Richie Kotzen record, you know, Native Tongue, like they're trying to kind of blend in and morph. And other bands, like for example, you know, Guns N' Roses, or I just did a big podcast about the Police yesterday. They had so many different styles that, and they, you know, the Beatles and Zeppelin, these bands were not allowed to do that. Like the Crew was not allowed to do brooding, angry music, even though it was great because they're Motley Crue. It's girls, girls, girls. And Poison is Talk Dirty to Me. You can't do a bluesier record. It's like they weren't allowed to even branch out to try and adapt.
I mean, there's a scene in our book where Brian Forsyth from Kix, after, you know, during like, it's like 94 or something, and he gets an audition for the Wallflowers.
Oh, right.
And he goes in and like, you know, dude, Kix, I mean, they weren't the biggest band of the era, but they had like a number nine single and a platinum record. Like it's, you know, a great. So, and he goes in, does not even mention that he was in Kix.
Right. That's, you know, a detriment. I
mean? Like you can't even be like, that's a matter of like, dude, you're in one of the best live bands of the era. And you're just like, and Cher Ross from Vixen, the same thing. She was like out doing auditions after Vixen. She's like, I didn't mention that I was in Vixen for 10 years. And they weren't allowed to reinvent themselves. And I mean, it's partially too, look, the Motley Crue, you know, videos are great, but they're awesome. And they were fun when we were 15, but they are corralling women into like cages and stuff like that.
Oh dude, it's insane.
Like, so like there's a lot of smoking guns. Like they left, there was like a lot of evidence if people wanted to be like, you can't just switch to being, you know, thoughtful and serious.
But you know what though, dude, I think it's more because of the music. Like this is not like, that's it, true. Went from 1989 to 2021. That's like true. Nobody, there was no cancel culture, Me Too. It was more just like, you were in a successful rock and roll band from LA, you are now canceled because of your music.
Right, that's true. It's
they didn't even care that they were saying, you know, show your tits and all that sort of stuff. You know what I mean? When you guys did your interviews for your book, were they in person, were they over the phone? A mixture of both?
Mostly over the phone. I think there were a few things in person. There was a moment where I sort of backed Reb Beach into a corner downstairs at a little bar that he was playing with Winger in Denver, in order to get him and then eventually Kip on the phone. But the interviews didn't happen in person.
You have a lot of characters. You know, there's a lot of great stories and we can talk about some of them. Is there any great stories about when you're trying to nail these guys down for interviews? Like, you know, Nikki Sixx, not easiest guy to get on the phone, you know, Slash, all these types of guys. These are rock and roll Hall of Fame caliber guys. When you finally get them involved, was it easy to get them? Was it hard? Were you calling them a few times? That sort of thing?
I mean, it took me 18 months to get Sebastian Bach.
Really?
I have like 18 months of emails of like, hi, just checking in again. Yeah, it's Tom from the book. You know, whatever. He's like on tour. When he's on tour, he doesn't do any press. When he's, you know, and just again, you're not asking people to promote something. Same, like, I think it took me quite a long time to get Ricky Rocket from, you know, like he was like, it's like you're saying, who's involved, who's involved, who's involved. And eventually you're sending these like a pitch letter for an interview. and you like your list is long enough that like people are going to be like, all right, screw it. I'll talk to this guy. And then some people we did have to rely on older interviews. Some people like I'm not going to sit here and tell you we got everybody. Like some of it's older interviews. And then if that we really, really had to, you know, we would go to archival. But like, you know, Rich got Ozzy, you know, like he basically like, you know, some of it was not through traditional means. Like he was interviewing Sharon and he's basically, can I talk to Ozzy too? And she's like, yeah, sure. You know,
whatever you got to do, right?
Yeah. So a lot of it was just that. And a lot of it was, you know, people that you're on the phone with saying like, hey, yeah, I'll send a text. I'll hook you up with this person. And then you kind of go from there. But yeah, like Sharon was another one. She was on board right from the beginning, but then it was just like, every time we got to the interview day, it would be canceled because something came up. And these things can go on for 6 to 8 months, you know, a year. And as long as you keep asking, then usually somebody would come through. You know, I mean, one funny one that sort of didn't come through was I was actually on the phone with Gene Simmons, who wound up not doing an interview for the book. I was talking about something else. And then I told him all about the book. And, you know, kids are not necessarily that big a part of this, but they're sort of there in the ether. So I thought it'd be nice to get some quotes from him. And I told him all about it. And he sort of paused and he was like, no offense, but I don't want to be in a book that also has crocus in it. And I was like, well, you know, I was like, if it makes any difference to you, crocus is not in the book. And he just goes, you know what I mean. And that was that. So it's like, okay, well, you know, Kiss are sort of not the focus of the book anyway, but it's like you try and like some people are going to say yes, some people aren't.
Great pull from Gene to use crocus.
Right.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Let's talk about how you guys put this book together, because it's written, if anybody is listening that's read The Dirt, it's kind of that sort of style of book, which makes it very easy to read. And it's very intriguing, like I said. And that's when I was like, how are they going to do this? Because we've read them all before. But having the actual quotes and, you know, this guy says this. But you put them all in sections. And there's some great chapters and sections and ideas and thoughts about how you group these people together. How did you organize that?
That was sort of the whole ball game. Like kind of what we did is we follow. So the way the book is structured is it's following, let's say it's 10, I'm making that number up, bands from 81 and then through time. And so kind of what we did was, once we had done a bunch of interviews for the book, it kind of became clear who was going to take which band and also who is obsessed with what. Like I was doing White Lion. There's no way I'm not doing White Lion. You know, Rich loves all of the like sleazy LA stuff, like Faster Pussycat, all that stuff. Like that's his beat. But so what we did is we wrote all of the stories all the way through. So like I wrote the whole White Lion thing and the whole Warren thing from beginning to end. Like we would write the whole story of the bands and then end the other chapters. And then we kind of just sat there for 3 days straight at Rich's house, chopping up the longer stories of the bands into the chapter so that they flow from one to another and the reader isn't getting completely confused. So we took the full narratives of each band and then sliced and diced them together so they seem thematically, like, I'm not exactly sure how we pulled it off, but that was how we did it. We wrote in one lane and then we started switching lanes, and it was tough. And some bands, because it's this oral history format like The Dirt, for every event you need multiple people talking about it. And some bands that we talk to and that we apologize to in the back of the book kind of get left out because there was no context around them. Like Enough's Enough, I interviewed both Chip and Donnie, and it's like there just wasn't enough, because they're from Chicago, there's not enough stuff.
Didn't fit, right?
Yeah. And so some people just got nuked, like Dangerous Toys, same thing. They kind of got nuked because there was just not enough stuff around them. So, but that's what we did. We just sliced up all of these things in a row, and it somehow came together in a way that was, you know, entertaining. But it was, that was a lot. That was like very nerve wracking.
What are some of your favorite parts of the book, Rich? Some of your favorite sections?
The Dawkins stuff is all great, just because those guys are completely insane to begin with. And then also just the way they relate to each other is just nuts.
Explain.
Yeah, well, people who are into this stuff know the whole, like, Don Dawkins and George Lynch are not buddies.
Right.
Even back in the day, it was like the one band where it was clear. Even, you know, Motley Crue, we know now those guys have a lot of issues with each other. But in like 1985, you were like, these dudes are like a gang. Like they
hang out together.
Yeah. Even when they're not rocking on stage, right. Like they must live together and like go swimming together. Yeah.
We always envision it to be like the Beatles and Help, where they go to four right. doors and they open the door and it all leads to one big giant apartment.
Yeah. Right. Like that's Motley Crue, you know, but like. Yeah. Even in 1985, you knew that like Don Dawkins and George Lynch hate each other. Like it was just something that was sort of like out there in the world. But some of the stories that we get into in the book, and one in particular, and it's an example of like just sort of following a thread that you didn't necessarily know existed. I think it was started with Tom interviewing Tom Werman and him talking about producing Dawkins' Tooth and Nail record, which is sort of their make and break record at the time. It's their first record for Elektra and all this stuff. Like there's a lot on the line. And it sort of comes out that in the studio, they spent maybe more time trying to like pull practical jokes on each other, in particular on George Lynch, than they did like concentrating on their career, which seems like a crazy thing to do at that moment. And the story in a nutshell is like, you know, they create this sort of tape of Tom Werman without his knowledge of like, they're just capturing different things he says in the studio and then splicing them together so that it comes out as like Tom Werman saying that like he wants to have sex with George Lynch.
Right.
And they play this for George Lynch and George freaks out. And then the next time Tom gives him any sort of direction on his guitar solo, he just goes crazy on Tom Werman and wants to like fight him. And Tom Werman doesn't know what the hell is going on because he hasn't heard this tape. And they go really into detail in it in the book. And it's not something we would have ever thought to ask had Tom Werman not said this thing to Tom. And then you start asking Don Dawkins about it and asking George Lynch and asking Wild McBrown. And they all corroborate the story and add to it. And it's a great story on its own. But then it's just like you start to think like, what the hell are these guys doing? Like they're... This right. is their shot, you know, they're on Elektra, they're in the studio with Tom Werman, you know, this is their moment after years and years of struggle. And like, this is what they're doing with it.
Right.
And, you know, they come out okay, but they also, I think that's part of what speaks to the fact that they don't get to the level of a Motley or a Guns N' Roses. And maybe they could have, like, not just because of an incident like this, but this is probably what was going on in their band the whole time.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because you hear a lot of stories, you know, okay, well, Don ripped off the advance from me. Well, George took my song off the record. And it's like, well, that's not how it happened. Well, that's not how it happened. And it's like, right. especially for the Dawkins camp, because they were always known as being dysfunctional, which is funny because they put a record out called that. But I've had Don on Talk Is Jericho. And I've had George on Talk Is Jericho with Michael Sweet, who you also interviewed when they did their project. And Don was a great guest. And George was probably the worst guest I've ever had. Like he was like Michael, actually, because Michael and I are pretty tight. He called me after, like, dude, I'm so sorry. Like, I apologize. I'm like, well, it's not your fault. The guy just didn't want to say anything. And anything he said was just like shitty. And I'm like, I get this. You know, right. You understand you're doing an interview. And if this is what you're getting, I can see how there's this dichotomy of personalities, and Don was great, like I said. And this is where you can kind of tell, or you know, Sebastian and Snake and Rachel. I know why Snake and Rachel don't want to have anything to do with Sebastian anymore. He's a handful. He's impossible to get along with. And you can see these things kind of come out in the book. And it was just very interesting to hear everybody's perspective on everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, especially with like, it's amazing what people were willing to do when they understood that they had achieved the chemistry that they needed to make it, mm-hmm. you know, like when you are reading our story of Skid Row, like, it's not like suddenly, and it, again, this is not to say like, I'm not bagging on Sebastian Bach. He would also admit he is an incredibly high energy dude. Even now, like, you, if you're in a room with him, I haven't been in a room with him, but I can imagine like you're kind of like pinned up against the wall because he's just like,
yeah, you can't get a word in edgewise. Right. Right.
So like these, you know, they fly Sebastian Bach in from Canada, like to audition for Skid Row. And they've been trying to find a singer for a year, you know, and like they found this kid, and he's not only is he an amazing singer, but he's like beautiful.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like
he's genetically created in a lab to be a rock star.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And like the first thing he does is like walk into Snake Sabo's house and go up to his mom and go, "Hey, I'm Sebastian. I got a 9-inch dick." You know what I mean? And like, it's just like, do you know what I mean? And like, that's like 3 minutes in to their career.
Right.
But you realize like these guys, and it's not the only, it's not like a unique thing in this book, but it's one of, I think, the recurring themes. They know like, this is the band, you know, like this is the band.
This is the chemistry.
This is, and the same thing happens when CC DeVille, you know, there's two people auditioning for Poison. There's Slash. It really comes down to Slash and CC DeVille.
That's such a great story. You know?
And Slash walks in. I mean, Slash doesn't really want the gig. He was going to take the gig if he got it because Poison were big.
And plus Slash has no gig. He wants to get a job, right?
So he walks into this thing. He's learned all the songs, and like, you know, his quote in our book is, "I played the shit out of those songs." You know, CC DeVille walks in. He hasn't learned any of the songs. He's like, yeah, I got this song, Talk Dirty to Me. Check it out, you know? And like, and he plays them this song. And Ricky and Bobby from Poison are like, this is the guy. Yeah, this is the guy. And Brett is like, I think immediately, like, I can't stand this guy. You know, like, and Brett is like, let's get Slash. This dude Slash is awesome. And it's that, but they somehow know, because people are like, can you imagine what Poison would have been like with Slash? And the answer to the question is, no, you can't, because we wouldn't be talking about Poison.
Right. They wouldn't have made it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's exactly right. You know, as Slash even said, CC comes in with like a pink blazer and, you know, high heeled shoes, and I come in with my moccasins and in a leather jacket or whatever. But you notice, because obviously band, and you guys know this, we all know this, it's all about chemistry. It's like a hockey team or a football team. The guy that might be the flashiest might not fit in best with the band. And the thing with Sebastian too, that I felt very interesting as well, is that he, in his mind, when he was doing all of these things that made the news, from, you know, the bottle incident and the homophobic shirt that he was wearing, he said that he was reading an article that said the new bad boys of rock and roll. And he's like, I was never told this. I was never consulted about this. So if you want a bad boy, here it is. That was part of the image at that point in time. And it's almost like, it's like wrestling. The idea is to make it look like you're hurting somebody without hurting somebody. The idea was to make it look like you're a bad boy without actually being one. But I don't know if a lot of those guys could do that. And we could see in the, you know, all the drug addicts and breakups and fights and issues that happened. You know, I think Bon Jovi was probably the best at maybe kind of looking like some kind of a bad boy, or at least some kind of a lascivious, you know, banging all the strippers and living the rock and roll lifestyle that really didn't do anything wrong. But other than that, the rest of them kind of fell right all into that trap.
I think so. And yeah, I mean, Sebastian, you look at him, when all that is happening, he's like 20 years old. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, think about what our, you know, sort of mind frame.
Well, a lot of those guys too, mm-hmm. right? A lot of those guys were in their early 20s when they started making big money.
Right. And so, yeah, I mean, Sebastian in particular, like, he was supposed to be this dangerous, like, on the edge guy. And like, he took it a little too far sometimes. But how do you know where that line is? And also, he's not really thinking about where that line is. Like, he's there because he really is this dude. The same way, mm-hmm. like, Axl Rose is really that dude. And you see that in the book as well. Like, even when they're just
right.
playing the clubs,
real
like
deal.
He is a volatile, real deal type of guy. I mean, Duff talks in the book about the first time he ever sees him perform. And he's like, you know, it reminded me of when I saw like Black Flag with Henry Rollins for the first time.
Right.
It's like, he was that intense. So a lot of these guys, what they were celebrated for, could also get them in a lot of trouble. And it wasn't, some of them were more calculating about it than others, but a lot of them, it was just like, this is the way they were living. And you put them on a stage and you put them in a situation where they have everything that they can want, you know, or could ever imagine. Like, they're going to kind of go crazy with it. And that's not, that's certainly not something that is particular to 80s hard rock.
Yeah, it still happens, you know, with athletes and, you know, anybody that sees fame and money at a very young age. Like you mentioned earlier, Rich, remember what we were like as 20-year-old kids, you know?
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Something that's very interesting, too, and I'm a big fan of Decline of the Western Civilization Part 2. I've had Penelope on the show. It's a great documentary. I just watched it again the other day, actually, after reading your book. Something that, another thing that people will never understand is the culture on the Sunset Strip of flyering. Explain exactly what that was and just how important and integral that was to making it in LA at that time.
It was everything, because there was no, imagine a time with no Facebook, right, and no Instagram, and where there you are competing with 5,000 other bands on the strip. The way that, you know, the bands advertise themselves is that they put up 8x10 posters for their bands, and they did it everywhere. And it was not just, it was a war, not just because they were competing, but because there was strategy. I mean, we have the guys from Warrant explaining that they had gridded out maps of LA, you know, because they were going to hit every phone pole. You know, they're like, we would take this quadrant and then that quadrant to the beach and then here, there. And whoever got the most flyers up got the most recognition. And people were, you know, going over each other's flyers. They would like tear down other people's flyers. And going back to Warrant, there's a thing in our book where they make the cardinal error of putting their gig flyer over a Guns N' Roses flyer. And it might have even been for a Guns N' Roses show that had already happened, but like, still, they put their branding over Guns N' Roses branding. And, you know, on their flyers that show like our gig, we're playing Starwood or whatever, there's a phone number for their hotline, which is probably like an answering machine at their girlfriend's house or whatever. But like one day they're checking their hotline and it's like, hey, this is Duff McKagan. You guys ever poster over us again, we're going to come kick your ass. And that's what it was like. I mean, you are, it's do or die. And then it's revealed in the book, which one of the funniest little tiny details is that the reason Poison was able to put up more flyers than everybody else and therefore dominate was that CC DeVille's mother owned a copy shop.
It's funny because I know Duff, he's another good friend of mine. He actually calls in a joke every Friday. It's like the worst dad jokes. It's called the Duff McKagan Joke of the Week. And he's such a different guy now. But once in a while, he'll text me something or say something. Or like, you need me to come out there and fight somebody? Or like, and I'm like, this is a guy that used to, you know, these guys were ready to fight. They would fight anybody, you know, to protect the brand, right? That was kind of part of the scene too.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, these guys, and it's funny, like the Warrant flyer probably was something ridiculous where it said like Sex Police on it or something, you know, like knowing the way they were.
Melts in your mouth, not in your hand.
Right. Or and then Duff sees this and he's probably like, what the?
Yeah.
But yeah, and that's another thing you get when you read the book, like just the competition. And there's a lot of camaraderie and the bands talk about that as well. But like you're in a space, especially in the mid 80s on the strip, where there's like probably 40,000 bands and they all look more or less the same and they're all competing for the same eyeballs. And like, you got to do whatever you can to make your band stand out. It's interesting. This is like a little later in the era, but Stevie Rochelle from Tuff talks about in the late 80s when he's kind of starting out and they're trying to make a name for themselves. And it gets into this whole conversation about pay to play, which most people you know, everybody just hates pay to play and like it's inauthentic and all this kind of type of thing. But he's like, actually, I didn't see it as a bad thing. You know, he's like, we were in such competition with everyone. If you want that opening slot ahead of Warrant at the Troubadour or whatever, like you should be a band that could sell some tickets and you should be a band that is confident enough in yourself that you'll lay the money out ahead of time because you know you'll make the money back. So he's like, I didn't see it as a bad thing. He's like, whatever, you know, you had to have that sort of confidence in yourself to be like, yeah, I'll sell those tickets. Like I'll put up the money up front in order to do it. So it was an interesting sort of take on it, but it also showed like, you know, the competition was so fierce in those days. And there was just so many, I mean, it's great. There were so many fans, but there were so many bands as well.
I mean, and that's sort of like the one of the beautiful or really great things I think about the decline of Western civilization part two is that it shows you,
you can see it,
the line between, and this is why we're, you know, even getting back to our chemistry thing, like the line between like a band like Odin that doesn't make it, or, you know, the bands that almost made it, most of them didn't suck. They just weren't great. And like you needed every little inch of every little advantage to be the band that made it.
You know, it's interesting too, because even talking about, you know, get out of the strip and into the arenas, you forget, like I said, I mean, obviously we always remember Motley Crue and Bon Jovi and all that sort of thing. And then there was kind of the second wave of bands that were hovering at that level. Rat was an arena band. We mentioned, I mean, Poison kind of was a little bit bigger. Cinderella, another great example of a band that played, they made it all the way to the arenas. And I remember going to see Cinderella on the Heartbreak Station tour in Calgary when I was living there. And it was in the Saddle Dome in Calgary where the Flames play. And there was probably, I don't know, 3,000 people in a place that held 20. And you could see where you're just like, ah, they almost got there and they just didn't quite make it. Why do you think those bands didn't go the extra mile to become, you know, that legendary status of Motley Crue or Bon Jovi?
I think sometimes, I mean, it's just the intangible factor, but even when you look at a band like Cinderella, who you mentioned, who were almost there and were super talented and actually have really great songs, there is some discussion in the book about how, you know, Tom Kiefer still as an onstage presence isn't the same as, you know, Vince Neil or Bret
great
Michaels
point.
Or any of these guys. And I think it's also talked about in the book how offstage he was sort of like he went home at the end of the day and like, and he was a normal, he wasn't a lunatic. And actually it helped to be a lunatic in those days. So I think you had bands like that where it sort of goes back to what even Tom was saying about that sort of, you know, it has to be the exact right mix of people. You know, this, that's an example of like Cinderella actually kind of was the right mix of people. But even when you were just missing that one little factor, maybe that's enough to not put you over the top in the same way.
No, their manager, Larry Mazur, he says, you know, like, look, he didn't want to be a he wasn't dating an actress. He didn't crash a car, Tom Kiefer, you know, and so that was it. But that's a really, in our book, like that Heartbreak Station tour is really like we use it because we can't cover every tour in the book, but the Heartbreak Station tour and the amount of money that Cinderella spends to build that set and the fact that they go out on, and you saw it, they go out on this tour with like 10 trucks. And this is at the end, this is like very symbolic for, in our book, for the whole end of the era. And even their manager at the time, Larry, is telling Tom Kiefer like, dude, it's too big. It's too big. It's too big. And he's like, you know, and Tom Kiefer's like, no, Motley Crue's got the drum set that flips over and this, that, the other thing. I want to be as big. Which is completely like a very understandable human impulse. But when that tour goes out and within like a couple weeks, they're like sending trucks home. Mm. They're sending the stage home. They're sending this home. That's where you really see in the book this era crumbling under the weight of its own sort of like, you know, pretensions. Like they just go out and they just don't have the goods. And it's just like,
It's so interesting because you hear that. I remember reading in Dee Snider's book when he talked about the Come Out and Play tour for Twisted Sister, which is the one after Stay Hungry. And same thing. They had this big stage with the, it looked like, I think Cinderella's looked like a New Orleans porch and Twisted Sister's looked like a Brooklyn ghetto, like a back alley. And like three or four shows in, they just have to cancel. That must be so disheartening for a band, because like you said, I understand you got to spend money to make money, and it worked for Iron Maiden. It worked for other bands that went bigger than they should have, than they were ready to get to the next level. But for Cinderella, when it doesn't happen, you're probably thinking, well, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Cinderella story is, I mean, it's funny too. It's one of my favorite stories in the book, because it's very funny, but it's like very subtly funny. And even on that Heartbreak Station tour, I mean, I think it starts off, they're talking about doing the record, and it's about them kind of getting back to their roots and, like, you know, acoustic guitars and like Stones and like just doing this very rootsy sort of back porch thing. And then like immediately the next quote is like, so we hit the road and we have 10 trucks, and then, like, you know, Tom Kiefer's going to come down from the rafters, right, and then the Cinderella sign is going to come up. It's going to explode into flames. And it's like completely the exact opposite of what their intention was, but you just get caught up in the moment. But it also shows, like, I think you're so, even though that's 90, 91, like, you're so sure of your success that you're probably shocked when it doesn't work out that way, especially a band like Twisted Sister come out and play. You're talking about, like, 1985, 1986, when there's no reason to think that you're going to have anything other than massive multi-platinum success. And then when it doesn't happen, like, a lot of times you're just, I mean, there's not necessarily even a reason for it. Like, Twisted Sister should have remained big. I mean, it wasn't the greatest record, but, you know, in 1986, like, the fact that it all fell apart is probably pretty shocking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, like we said, it happens. I mean, I think if Cinderella, you know, the people say if they would have come out a few years earlier, if you're talking about that Heartbreak Station era, Cinderella, if they would have come out a couple years later, I mean, they're basically the Black Crowes with, like, a hair metal past, so to speak. But there was a lot of bands that happened to, you know. You mentioned some of the stories. Like, what are some of your other favorite stories from the book that stand out to you?
For me, the one that, like, is the best, and it's another Tom Werman story, but I remember doing an interview with Tom Werman, who produced. So for people who don't spend their time looking at the back of records.
Like us.
Yeah, like, yeah. He produced, he Shout at the Devil, Theater of Pain, Girls, 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 and then Poison, Open Up and Say. He did a lot of the records.
Everything.
Everything. And he's like a very dry, he has a bed and breakfast in Massachusetts now. That's what he does. It's like he got completely out of the business. He's very dry. And my favorite story was, he's talking about making Poison Open Up and Say Ah. And he's like, I liked Poison. They worked very hard. But the solo to Nothing But a Good Time took all day. And I'm like, why? And he's like, well, CeCe DeVille kept going into the bathroom and doing something that I believe involved combustible cocaine. And it's like, and he's like, and it took 8 hours. And I'm like, I could just see. And then he's like talking about CeCe DeVille, like the first time they meet, going, Mr. Werman. I hear you like to do drugs. And like, to me, like the CC, because I love CC DeVille. Like, I think that he's my favorite band is Cheap. Like, one of my favorite bands is Cheap Trick.
Right.
And so to me, like, Rick Nielsen, like, CC DeVille is the next Rick Nielsen. Like, he's just like amazing character and like so much energy there. So hearing that the solo to the song that the book is named after took all day, because basically the guy was freebasing, to me, like, I called Rich afterwards. I'm like, you're not going to believe this.
It's very apropos. It fits perfectly.
Exactly.
But I have to add to that. And I mean, Tom interviewed Ricky Rocket as well. But the thing I like in the book, the next line after that is Ricky Rocket going, but it's a great solo.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, it is.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
All right, what about you, Rich? Any other favorite stories from your book, Nothing But a Good Time?
I think for me, I mean, the whole Skid Row story to me is a great story. just from beginning to end, because in addition to the Sebastian Bach element, all the dudes in the band are just hilarious guys.
Yeah.
Which you probably know. I mean, Snake is great and Rachel's great and Scotty's great. And we have Rob Afuso is in there as well. The fact that we got all five guys on record was cool because a lot of them don't talk to each other anymore, obviously.
Right.
But they all tell this story in such a great way. And like what Tom mentioned about that first night where Sebastian's there and he comes into Snake's house and talks about the size of his dick to Snake's mom is great. But then they go on to tell in detail the story of the entire first night together. Like, that's how it starts. But you get all these great details because then, like, Scotty's talking about how Sebastian's, like, stomping around the house and, like, going through cans and cans of Aquanet and then, like, finishing them and then throwing them over his shoulder behind him. And then like they go out to this club Mingles in Sayreville, New Jersey. And like they go on stage and they play and it's awesome. But then afterward they're in the parking lot and someone says something to Sebastian and he starts like fighting the dude. And so, and you know, and Scotty's like, dude, you're from Canada. You're in Jersey. Like, what are you doing? You know, but like all of a sudden they're in this fight in a parking lot. They get him out of there. Then they go to a White Castle and Rob Afuso is like, someone says something about the way that we look. He's like, fists start flying again. So like now they're in another fight later on. And like, then the cops are coming. They all jump in the car. They get out of there. And it's like, this is their first night together.
Right.
And it's like all this crazy stuff happens, but they all tell the story and it's just wild and it's hilarious.
Another great story. And it's one of the classic moments in rock and roll history that you could never do in this day and age because the situation has changed, is going to Russia for the Make Difference Foundation, or also known as the Make a Different Drink Foundation.
Yeah.
Kind of recapitulate that story that involves probably five or six of the craziest bands of all time on a private jet flying from America to Russia to do a charity show for like anti-drinking and drugs.
I mean, that story is so wild because you've always heard about like this, that this plane ride was completely insane because they stopped, you know, Ozzy gets on and this, that, the other thing. And there was actually stuff like, you know, some people, the one thing that people didn't do in our book, which was very smart of them, nobody ever says they see somebody else doing drugs.
Right.
Like they were very, but like that, everyone for that. And then, but like the thing is like, then they get to Russia and they're like, that whole thing is so wild because you forget like that this, what the Soviet Union was like, like probably in 1989. Like they get there and they're the biggest rock bands in the world, but they bring all of their own food.
Yeah.
They bring all of their own toilet paper. Like they bring everything that they need because they, and then they end up like the nicest hotel that they can find is still like you turn the lights on and cockroaches scatter everywhere, you know? And it's, so it's like a completely crazy scene. They're being followed around by the KGB. The Russian bikers are all there to see Ozzy and encircling the hotel and chanting for him. It's like this really, actually, that is a movie that needs to be made. Is
sure, because you know, yeah, it's Ozzy, it's Motley Crue, it's Scorpions, it's Bon Jovi and Skid Row.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, you see there like a lot of the ego and the business side of it too, because there's like this behind the scenes struggle of who's going to close the show.
Right.
And so you've got like Ozzy and Bon Jovi, you know, and Motley Crue, and they're kind of like all managed by the same guy. But like, again, like what we were saying, these people are colleagues, but like, they're still like that when it comes down to like, who's closing this show, the gloves come off. You know, and it's like, I'm closing the show. No, you are. And then it's like, and there was, you know, these bands, there was a lot of ego and there was a lot at stake and a lot of people throwing their weight around, you know, back then. It was big business.
Who did end up going on last?
It's Bon Jovi because of MTV.
Ah, even though Ozzy was way more popular, right?
Yes. That's what happens, right, Rich? Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think so. I'd say that there might be a thing where the person who closes is not the person, like on MTV, they show it as a different closer, but I'm actually not sure.
Flopped it.
It's either Bon Jovi or Ozzy, I think. Oh, no, it's definitely not Ozzy. So I think you're right, Tom. I think it is Bon Jovi.
And apparently the whole time in Russia, all the kids want is Ozzy.
Right.
Like they're like watching Bon Jovi. They're like, what is this? This is not Ozzy. They're just like, Ozzy. Because the Black Sabbath records had been sneaking into Russia,
right,
or the Soviet Union for 20 years. So like Ozzy is a true legend. But that story is just amazing.
Yeah.
There's some great stories of Ozzy and Motley Crue on the 84 tour that are pretty crazy as well.
Yeah. And that's, you know, like the sort of the Nikki Six Ozzy thing with like the snorting of the ants and the licking up of the urine. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that's like, you know, rock and roll lore now in the same way as like Zeppelin with the mud shark. But the thing that's great about it in the book too is you get these other perspectives. A lot of the story is told through the perspective of Jakey Lee, who we talked to for the book a few times and who was Ozzy's guitarist at the time, obviously. And he tells the story in such a dry, like, reporting sort of way. And he's also so, like, disgusted by it at the same time. Like, he's, like, so kind of fed up with it. And so it's really funny to hear it from his perspective. And actually, there's some stuff we even didn't include because it was a little bit over the top. And we were like, well, we don't know if that's exactly what happened. And we're not. And people could get in trouble here.
More over the top than snorting ants and yes. licking each other's piss.
Yeah. Wow. So, and so to tell you something. So we were like, that was okay. But then other stuff, yeah. we were like, we can't print yeah. that. But even just the way he's sort of reporting on the fact of like, Ozzy's trying to get in shape. So he thinks he's in good shape then. So he's challenging Nikki, you know, to a push-up contest. And then, you know, Jake's like, Nikki did like 10 push-ups. He's like, Ozzy did one. You know, it's just like, it's so insane what's going on that it's just like, it's the story that just keeps on giving, really.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That tour is, there's so many characters in this book. Who were some of your favorite guys to interview that were great storytellers?
Bobby, oddly, Bobby Rock of Nelson.
Oh, wow.
His book is actually really good.
Yeah, I've read it.
He is amazing on the phone. And the way he describes, because he wasn't one of the Nelson brothers, the madness of that tour. And like, you know, he's like, yeah, on that tour, like basically you could go to the hotel. And if you wanted to hook up that night, there were girls trolling the hallways looking for us. And you literally had to open the hotel room door, peek your head out and like count down to 10 seconds. And like somebody would come around. But like, there's something about, there's people who know how to talk.
Right, sure.
I don't know if you know Gunnar Nelson, but like yeah. he too, like he's when he's talking about like, you know, Poison and how Poison, like their first initial marketing thing was that they catered to the bigger girls because they would be right. the most loyal fans. And he's just like, it was the best marketing flow I've ever seen. They were geniuses, you know. But there's people who just know like where you're doing the interview and you're like checking off boxes. You're like, this yeah. is gold. This is gold. This is gold. This stays in. Amazing. You know, so oddly, they were two of the best. And also like Ricky Rocket was very honest and forthcoming and great.
What do you think, Rich?
I would say two guys that immediately come to mind. One is Stevie Rochelle from Tough, who I don't know if you ever spoke to him before, but he's this guy who like beyond having been a part of the scene is like just a super fan. Like doesn't just know everything about all the bands that we know, but like we'll talk to you about the difference between the bands Paradise and Pair-a-Dice, you know, who were both on the strip right. in the late 80s. And like, he just knows all this stuff about every layer of band and can really talk about it in a very knowledgeable and just detailed way. In addition to being able to tell his own story, which has a lot of interesting details to it. So he was one guy who talked to several times and would have just, you know, loved to include. We just tried to include him as much as possible, as much as you can also include that perspective. And then the other guy is Tamey Down from Faster Pussycat, who is just everything you would imagine and hope that Tamey Down from Faster Pussycat would be, which is like he is the living embodiment of Faster Pussycat music, which is like he is raw and open and sleazy and sort of and funny. And was also like a total scenester. Like he was there, you know, in addition to the Faster Pussycat stuff, he's hanging out with the Guns N' Roses guys. He's starting the Cat House with Ricky Rackman. And we go super deep into what that whole scene was like. And he is just a guy who is very open about what he was doing, what his intentions were, what he was after. And, you know, makes no apologies for any of it. And like you ask him a question, he's going to give you an answer and it's going to be a great answer.
last few questions for you. Now that the book has been released and you have all these guys included, have you gotten some great feedback, not only from the fans, but from the guys that were included in the book?
We have. And, you know, it's really super gratifying. I interviewed him a bunch of times from the book, but like, you know, Brian Forsyth from Kix, it really, because you take up a lot, like I interviewed him a bunch for this, and like, you end up taking up a lot of a person's time,
right?
You know? And so like, to have them be like, oh, I really enjoyed it. And like, Rich got an email from Warren Demartini saying that we got it right.
That's, you know, cool.
Most, we haven't gotten, I'm waiting for the one that's like, what did you, you know? But I think that people are really happy that we did a real serious, I mean, not serious, like it's serious. It's a funny book where it's funny, but like that we really went all in on this music. And it, like, as a fan since the age of 15, like feeling that like the artists in there appreciate the book in general is like, it's probably actually the most gratifying. Like it's selling really well and all that stuff. And that's great. Like we made New York Times bestseller list, but like to me, the email from Warren Demartini. It's like, yes.
Yeah. No, I mean, that kind of stuff means a lot because we weren't writing this book to please them. Like we needed to be honest about what happened. And like, we all know, like a lot of these stories, like these bands were nuts and they did a lot of stuff that maybe they don't want to talk about all the time, but everybody has been so supportive and that's been great. It's also been a little bit of a relief, you know, like Scotty Hill wrote to us. You know, he's just like, dude, I can't believe like you guys talk about Garden State Music, you know, like the guitar shop that they all used to work at. Like, I think a lot of them, their minds are blown to like see this stuff from their past in print, because it's not the kind of stuff that they even talk about in interviews all the time. So it's just like, it's been cool to get that feedback, you know, like Dee Snider has posted about it a lot. Brett posts about it. You know, he's posted about it a few times. So like to see the support from these guys when we were really just trying to be super honest in how we told the story has been a nice outcome.
Yeah, like I said, you guys really nailed it. I've told a lot of people to check it out and read it. It goes by so fast. It's a big book. You could knock somebody out with it if you don't like them, but it's well worth reading. Last question for you. It's a two-parter. Who do you feel the biggest band from that era is? And who's your favorite band from that era that you included in the book? Tom?
I think the biggest band is probably The Crew. I mean, like, of like, to me, because I feel that's specific to that era. I mean, like, maybe Bon Jovi was bigger in some weird way, like in terms of like, but to me, The Crew is the one that's like has the longest, biggest, most successful run and still means the most today. Like, they're the ones that have come to embody this music. Like, I think when people, like, if you're like, what'd you do a book about? I'm like, oh, it's about like, and they don't know anything. I'm like, bands like Motley Crue. And they're like, oh yeah.
Now we know. Exactly.
Like, you know, my favorite, oddly, I mean, I just can't, for me, the thing that got me, blew my mind and got me into it, the first two Poison records are really the records that like, where I like, and specifically like the Talk Dirty to Me video, that was the moment when I saw that video with CC with all of the guitars down the, like that, like literally, I think put me on the track that I've been on since then. So to me, I will always go down swinging for Poison.
For me, you know, biggest, maybe, I guess you could also make the argument that it's Guns N' Roses. They're the band. I mean, they're certainly a big part of this book, but people always argue about, well, whether or not they're even part of the scene. You know, musically, I guess you can have that conversation, but clearly when you read this book, like they were there and they were firmly entrenched in it. Like they're a huge part of it. So them, and then if not them, I'd agree with Tom. Like Motley Crue are the quintessential band of this era. And like, really, you know, our book doesn't start with Motley Crue, but Motley Crue is the beginning of, in my mind, the 80s Sunset Strip thing. Like it starts with Motley Crue appearing. And everything that happens after that, Motley Crue do it bigger and better and crazier than any band that comes after them. And every band that comes after them talks about Motley Crue. And so their impact and their influence can't be overstated. I mean, as far as my favorite band growing up, it was Motley Crue. Like the way Tom was when he saw the Talk Dirty to Me video was the way I was when I saw that Looks the Kill video. Like, yeah. I was seven and it was like instant connection. I was like, these guys are the coolest guys I've ever seen in my life. I didn't even notice that there were women in the video. Like, none of that,
right.
You know, none of that even registered in my 7-year-old, you know, lizard brain. But like, but the guys and the way they looked and the costumes and all of that, it was just like instant impact. And for the rest of the 80s, like, they were my band.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to say the biggest, I'll go something different because, like you mentioned, Crew and Guns N' Roses, you can't deny it. I think included in your book is not really an LA guy, but if you're talking about Ozzy, I think that's still the top of the food chain for pretty much almost everybody. Mm-hmm. At least from an influential standpoint. And like you said, when you go to Russia in a stadium, I still think Ozzy would probably get the biggest reaction to this day.
Absolutely.
You know, and favorite band? I mean, the first three Crew records blew my f-ing mind. I'm a huge Stryper fan. I love that band. I love Skid Row. So that's why this book was perfect for me. And there's millions of people like me that will enjoy this tome. So great job, guys. You did a hell of a job. And I know what it's like. I've written 5 books myself. It's not easy to do. So this is the fun part when you get to talk about it and have everybody tell you how great you are for writing it.
Totally. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having us. This was really awesome. It was great.
It's a thrill.
Thank you, guys. I look forward to future books. And like I said, I will be recommending this to everybody.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Talk to you later.